Woman is a feminist show about women making a difference and the men by their side. As 50% of the world's population and 53% of eligible U.S. voters, women are not a special interest group, and every woman should work and vote toward nothing less than 50-50 participation in the social, political, economic, legal, and environmental arenas. The views and opinions expressed on Every Woman are those of the hosts and guests and do not necessarily represent those of the KKFI staff, management, board, and the Midcoast Radio Project Incorporated. And good afternoon. This is Sharon Lockhart. I'm in the studio with Ebony today, Ebony Johnson. And Amy is out today with a very bad cold.
Yes, feel better, Amy.
And hopefully she will be listening. And our guests today are going to be Megan England and Barbara Bouillet, who are running for the Senate District 7, Senate Kansas House. Don't know if I said that in the way it should have been said, but Kansas House District 7. And they're going to be talking to us for a few minutes or half an hour about the positions and policies of Kansas and what they hope to do to help Kansas out. And in the interim, oh, and then later, our second guest is Zee Hall. Mm-hmm. Ebony, do you want to tell what she's going to be talking about?
Yes, Zee will join us to talk about last week. As many of you may know, we had a guest on, Melvin Merritt, talking about his feminist fears. And Sharon and Amy brought up that I was being protective of him. And so I wanted to take that on. My sisters and I talk about it. And I called Zee and said, you know, that I want to deal with this issue of black women being maybe overprotective of black men. And Zee said, I said, can you or anyone you know of? And she said, well, yes. And I've been having this conversation with other people. So we'll kind of step into a little bit of that and the history and feminism behind that.
And I might say that Melvin could never come to terms with using feminist fear.
Yeah, he said concern.
Concern. He corrected us every time. but now you have some news to share with us, don't you, Ebony?
We do have some news. Thank you, Sharon. Can cities be feminist? From Paris to Rome and Bethlehem to Baghdad, a wave of new female mayors is taking office and shaking up old assumptions about what matters to cities. 19% of big city U.S. mayors are women, but globally, the number of women mayors is rising. Paris, Barcelona, Montevideo, Prague, Cologne, Warsaw, Bucharest, Rome, and Baghdad are among the urban centers that have recently chosen, or in Baghdad's case, had appointed female leaders. Savette Gibson, who was appointed Painesville, Liberia's first female mayor, states, I always say women build differently than men. Men build for today, but women build for tomorrow, because we're interested in making sure we have some form of security for our children. That's why we elected a woman as president in Liberia. We knew we needed a woman to rebuild our nation, The Guardian reported October 12th. A church celebrated as the birthplace of feminism, Brighton's Old Town, is among the historic sites on a new list of heritage considered to be at risk in England. The church, which was extended in the 19th century, has been a listed building since 1953, but is now in need of expensive conservation work, The Guardian reported October 21st. And with that, Sharon?
Well, that first story was particularly good, since we have two female candidates here to talk to us about running for the Kansas Senate. And we are starting with Barbara. And you have a question for her, Ebony?
Yes, Barbara. And Barbara, can you clarify district you are?
We're running for Kansas Senate District 7.
Okay.
But I currently serve as district for the House in 21. So okay. It's Senate and House. We're Senate today.
Okay. All right. Thank you for that clarification. All right. So the first question for that both of you will respond to, but Barbara first. After 3.5 years of budget shortfalls caused by the 2012 and 2013 tax cuts, legislators, including Governor Sam Brownback, are now considering a tax increase. What would you like Kansas's new tax policy to look like?
Well, thanks for that question, Ebony, because it is probably the number one concern for Kansas and for the voters of Kansas at this time. And to clarify, I was present in the legislature at the time of that vote and voted no, not believing that Art Laffer trickle-down economics policy would work, and it has not. And we are in a horrific mess now.
Now, just a question for that, Barbara. But if this is correct, you were marked absent from the original vote on Brownback's tax plan, but you were present for all the other votes that day?
Yes, and okay. The reason I was absent that day is because I became ill, and I don't want to go into the details, It was unpleasant. And the reality is that if you are a no, it doesn't matter if you're a present no or an absent no. The only time that it is critical is if you're a yes and you do not show. We only count the votes for, which would be in the House 63, or in the Senate it would be 21 votes would be needed to pass something. And yes, if we want to go into absentee votes, most of the votes I've missed in my career, a very few because of illness and a very few because my father was dying. Mm-hmm. And those are times that we have issues when we do have to miss. The good news is I've never missed a vote where I needed to be a yes.
Okay. So your the new tax policy for Kansas, what would you like for it to look like?
Well, I will tell you, the first thing that we need to do is end the glide path to zero that the governor has put in place. There are two parts of that that are critical. One is the LLC release, no tax for the LLCs in our state, which are small business. And in the glide path to zero, the governor put those small businesses, he exempted them first and didn't have them even participating in the slow ratchet down of income tax. And then we also have this elimination of income tax totally for our state. And I would like to see that eliminated. I don't know that we will have to go back to the exact same rates that we had previously, but we may. And included in that, I think that we need to look at all of our tax plan and policy. It would be nice to put it all on the table. There are things that we maybe need to reduce taxes, such as food sales tax. That is not appropriate to have the highest or second highest in the country, but we do need revenue. So hopefully we will look at everything and put it all on the table and then see what is best. But certainly having income tax will be my own number one priority.
Okay. And Megan, same question for you. What would you like for Kansas's new tax policy to look like?
Sure. She did a really great job of explaining what the challenges are without having any income tax right now. So I would like to have the LLC exemptions overturned and the March to Zero ratchets removed. I'd also like to see local tax lids lifted so that our cities can have full authority over the security, the financial security of cities and local governments, counties, school boards can have the full authority on the success of their cities. I'd like to lower sales tax, not only on food, but in general. It's a very regressive form of revenue, and I think that it should be rebalanced back with property tax and income tax. I also think that there's some interesting things that we could do. We're so close to Colorado that we should be looking at bringing in revenue rather than spending all of our money trying to tie up criminals and putting people in jail for marijuana. I think that we could really learn from them and bring in a lot more revenue that way.
Thank you. Thank you both. And for just the next question here, school funding is being attacked from both sides, with some claiming our public schools are overfunded and some claiming they are underfunded. How do you think our school funding system measures up? Sharon,
do you want to start with Megan?
That would be what we agree on. Yeah, Absolutely. So in the 1960s, voters approved a constitutional amendment for our schools to be adequately and equitably funded. And that definition really falls to the courts to make sure that the legislature is providing both of those definitions. We have been in the courts over this issue for 25 years now, and legislature after legislature has really refused to live up to the expectations of voters in both of those issues. So we're right in the middle of those definitions right now, and the legislature we have today is not filling the bill. So I believe once in the last 25 years we hit constitutional obligations to meet those two definitions, and we just need to go back to that plan and fulfill our constitutional obligation and what voters and the people, especially of our district, expect in terms of funding for schools.
Okay. Sorry about that. And then also just what, if anything, do you propose to do for families with children in private school?
Me again?
Yes, just to follow up.
I private schools, private schools are private schools, and public schools are public schools, and taxpayer money should not have anything to do with private schools. That should be completely separate from any kind of public funding.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And Barbara, same question to you. How do you think our school funding system measures up? And then I'll follow up with the private school question as well.
Well, clearly it is not measuring up because we continue to have lawsuits, as Megan spoke of, and we are waiting for the current Gannon lawsuit to rule on adequacy, which in my estimation, after listening to the testimony, there will be a requirement or a ruling from the court that says, yes, you must add money into the schools. My guess is that they will direct that money towards students who are not currently meeting state requirements, are low on the scale of success, and ones that we specifically can target with money to increase. But overall, we still will need to increase our funding. I have always been a proponent of increased funding and have voted down basically all of our budgets every year because we haven't been funding our schools, among other things, properly. Now, I will go ahead and answer your question about private schools. Private schools, as Megan said, are private. We have the opportunity in the state to attend private schools, to attend online schools, to pick between a religious school or just a regular private school, and all of those are outside of the realm of our Constitution, which says funding our public education system. It should remain so. All of my votes have reflected a no for anything that includes vouchers in our school system. I do not support them.
Okay. And back to you, Barbara. In light of the Affordable Care Act's collapsing individual marketplace, do you believe it is time to expand Medicaid in Kansas? Or would it be better to wait to see what the next president will offer as a solution?
Well, all those things are critical. So I have been a very vocal proponent for expanding Medicaid in our state. One of the challenges of expanding Medicaid is that the system that we have in place to use Medicaid is called CanCare. And there are many issues and failings in that system that need to be resolved. So my proposal is to both expand Medicaid and to have legislation that will specifically reform our CanCare system. Currently, CMS, which is the Center for Medicaid Services, which is federal, oversees our waiver to have CanCare be our programming, which is three managed care organizations, which are private and are focused on revenues for themselves. Though the federal government has approved that and is currently reviewing it. And so, I would not be surprised if they do not approve our waiver for CanCare specifically and it changes.
Is CanCare capable of handling a Medicaid expansion?
Well, that's an interesting question because our state is struggling right now with having enough providers for everyone. So when you have things like this, having poor revenues, we've had a 4% cut across the board to providers in the CanCare realm, and that tends to lead to people leaving the system, not the people, but the providers. Mm-hmm. And so that puts us in more stress, and so that's why I would like to see reform. I have been a provider of Medicaid myself, and I understand the challenges of being paid enough just to meet your own budget. That's very important for providers. People who are providers are good people. They want to help the poor and to help those who need it. I've left out the piece, though, about the federal government. Depending on who is elected, it is potentially going to change the landscape of the Affordable Care Act. The Affordable Care Act was never meant to be something written in stone. It has always been said that it will be reformed as necessary. There are always things that can be improved, but the Affordable Care Act will not go away. I don't see how that will be possible. There are too many things in place. So with that being said, what happens to us in Medicaid in the state will be influenced by that. But until we're past November 8th, I can't really answer. We can all speculate. But for me, it is important to still stay on the side of expanding Medicaid.
Thank you for that. And Megan, same to you. I'll repeat it repeat the question for if necessary.
Sure.
In light of the Affordable Care Act's collapsing individual marketplace, do you believe it is time to expand Medicaid in Kansas, or would it be better to wait to see what the next president will offer as a solution?
Well, I haven't heard too many differences in either presidential candidate on major changes in the Affordable Care Act, so I don't anticipate many changes. Either way. But I will say, just since we have 1.4 billion dollars of Kansans' tax dollars that go to the federal government that are being held up because our Republican legislature and governor don't like our president. And so they are trying to send him a message to our detriment. Then we have accepting back our own federal dollars, we've created this new for-profit system. It has no accountability, no transparency, and it's for-profit. So it's already exceeded into the hundreds of millions of dollars since its inception. And every time service is cut from someone who's disabled or someone who's actually getting money from CanCare, they profit. So right now, disabled people have a 7 to 8 year wait for Kansas services. And that came about during the recession, but it hasn't gotten any better through CanCare. CanCare is predatory, and it is literally killing some of the people that use it. There's a man, used to be a Kansas City Star reporter, Finn Bullers, and he was a huge advocate of overturning the for-profit element of CanCare and put it back into the state where there's accountability. There used to be 200 providers, and now there's 19. And that really, a lot of that is because CanCare refuses to pay their bills. They have sometimes 2 years full of outstanding bills, and it's really difficult for small businesses to carry that much debt. Mm-hmm. So, of course, I do think that we should accept Medicaid back into, but I am not for any penny of federal dollars coming back into our system before the for-profit element of CanCare is overturned, because I don't think those insurance companies should have any more money without knowing that we can, that the money will be going towards the people rather than the for-profit insurance companies.
Okay. And you have some, you have a niece who's on the waiting list for CanCare?
Well, yes and no. I have a niece. We have signed papers. She will be our, we will have a guardianship over her at some point. They moved. She was born in Kansas. They moved to Utah. They just came back a couple years ago. They're supposed to be on this 8-year waiting list, and it's such a difficult system to try to navigate through that her parents have just given up. So she's facing an 8-year waiting list, mm-hmm. but technically she's not a part of it anymore.
Well, can I add in that that's one of the things that us as state senators, state representatives do, is when there's an issue with somebody that is not getting the services, that is the obligation and the hope that a patient or someone in need of services would actually contact us so that we can facilitate them getting it, and that's helpful.
Okay. And then just as a follow-up with you, Megan, is CanCare capable of handling a Medicaid expansion?
Well, I mean, I'm sure they're capable of it, but it would basically just continue and perpetuate this horrible system and where it's of profit over people. So I'm sure that they're open arms to have our $1.4 billion, because we're paying for CanCare, too. So any politician that says that we can't afford to expand Medicaid is just a bunch of hooey, because we're paying for both right now. So, yes.
Thank you. Barbara, Kansas has been losing jobs in 2016 with what some are calling a rural recession. What, if anything, could you do in the Senate to encourage job growth?
First thing I want to say is that it is not, the government doesn't create jobs. People create jobs, and I think that's a very important distinction to make. But what the government can do is facilitate the ability for people to work or to have certain incentives that may help them start a small business, for instance. So I have in the past supported efforts such as the PEAK program and other financial situations that will help organizations and businesses be able to get startup money. I think one of the things that's lacking is money for very small businesses. I would like to see that improved. Now, that being said, for rural areas, it's a real challenge. So the first thing that I would like to see happening for us as a state is to have an expansion of broadband services to ensure that everyone has access to what they need. That is a number one limiting factor for people who would like to be further out in the state and work from home, and that needs to change. And there are ways to expand certain monies that are already present that go to certain broadband organizations. Maybe they could be expanded into others. I think that needs to be looked at. The other thing that I've already do is participate and listen to those entrepreneurial programs such as the one I visited Thursday at University of Kansas. We have people who want to move small business and have new, great, fabulous ideas and would be willing to go into smaller areas of the state. And those are all great ways. I'm open to any, but again, my job is to facilitate and to stay out of the way, if you say, and let people move their businesses where they need to.
Thank you. Megan, same to you.
Do you repeat that, please?
I will. Uh-huh. Kansas has been losing jobs in 2016 with what some are calling a rural recession. What, if anything, could you do in the Senate to encourage job growth?
Well, I think this is a stark difference between my opponent and I. The state of Kansas is the number one largest employer in the state, and government absolutely can create jobs, and it's I think the onus of government to create jobs. There's construction. We could put money back into infrastructure again. Teachers, if we can fully fund schools and education, that's teachers and schools and administrators. Medicaid expansion, if we can do that, then boom, we've got more money going into the medical field. During the Great Depression, we had a different philosophy about how to recover. And what government did was put money into itself, and we created jobs just for the sake of creating them. There's an amazing, in Lincoln, Nebraska, where my husband is from, there's an amazing garden, a lot like Loose Park here. And it used to be a dump. It used to be a place that they kept trash. And so what they did was they said, you know what, we want to have an amazing park, so we're going to take this landfill and we're going to create it into a park, and we're going to hire people to do that. And so instead of having people unemployed and hungry and their kids hungry, what they were doing was investing in themselves, getting people back onto the payrolls and getting them into paying taxes and being part of the community. So I absolutely think that another thing that we can do is, let's create wind energy. Let's create solar energy. And that really has a lot to do with the rural areas. So manufacturing, I think there's a lot of potential there for widespread job growth throughout the state.
Thank you. And we do have a caller on the line that has a question for you too. Caller, are you there? You're on the air.
Yeah, I'm there. I actually have a question or two, but I had a quick comment I wanted to make about CanCare.
Okay, one second. Can you state your name and where you're calling from?
This is Drew and Olathe.
All right. And Drew, if you could just ask your question, we're closing in on the segment here. So if you could ask you had one or two questions you wanted to ask. I want to make sure we get those in.
Yeah, real quick, CanCare doesn't even, in the brochure, doesn't even mention subsidizing a gym membership, and that would actually save them money. As to my questions, I would ask why they can't remove the sales tax on food in its entirety. It's a regressive tax. Maybe we could buffer it up with the luxury tax or legalize marijuana and be done with it and use some of that tax benefits to subsidize where we would have taxed people on food, and I guess I'll leave it at that.
Okay, and you're either one of you with I think he hung up. And
those are good questions. Legalizing marijuana and what was the first point he brought up?
He said something about
food tax, grocery, the tax off groceries. Both, I think, marvelous.
Got to happen. And with Johnson and Wyandotte counties as the economic engines for the rest of the state, it would behoove us to make their sales tax way more competitive than Kansas City, Missouri, so we can have everyone that lives here come over across the state line.
And absolutely, especially on the food tax, I can tell you we have voted on this many, many times in the legislature, and it has always failed. And part of that is because there has been no other money to replace it with, because we haven't been able to actually have bills on the floor to move other tax policy forward. The good news is after the primary this year, there will be a very different legislature in place, no matter who is elected. And many of us are very excited to see some of the changes that many of us believe will include things like reducing and ultimately eliminating food sales tax and issues like that. I think it's a very positive thing for our state to look forward to. There will be changes.
Okay, and a final question for you here. Partisan politics can be exhausting to the average voter. What do you feel is the significance of having an R or a D next to your name? Republican or Democrat?
I don't know.
Is it Megan's turn?
Megan, you can.
Well, we have very different platforms. That's for sure. And the Democratic platform is actually more reflective of the people of District 7, Senate District 7. It's one of the most Democratic districts in the state, actually. Definitely the most in Johnson County. We believe for equality for all. We believe in fully funded public schools. We believe in having low sales taxes. And so I'm very proud to be a part of that party, especially living in Kansas, where to me, being of the Republican Party, it's really full of ideologues and kind of kooky people. You know, you've got Brownback, who has not done anything positive for the state. Got Kris Kobach, who's on an international level. We've got Virgil Peck, who would love to be a sniper to Hispanics across the state line, like pigs, I think is what he said. We've got one of the leaders in the House who just the other day talked about how we should start listening to Hitler. So, those are some pretty things that are very representative of what the Kansas Republican Party stands for today. And I'm not exactly sure what's keeping my opponent into that party, but she hasn't been very vocal about denouncing some of those people, let alone Donald Trump and the things that he's mm-hmm. said. So I'm a proud Democrat. I'm a proud progressive, and I'm looking forward to serving in the Senate.
I do want to, just as a follow-up to this, and then we'll go to you, Barbara. In previous years, there's been a coalition between moderate Republicans and Democrats in the Senate. Do you intend to participate in a cross-aisle coalition? If you could just answer quickly, and then we'll...
Oh, yeah. I have spent 8 years working across party lines trying to figure out where I can find agreement with other people who I might otherwise disagree with and move forward. I'm not into these stalemates where we just... where nothing gets done. I would work with as many people as possible.
Okay, thank you. And then the same question to you, Barbara. Partisan politics can be exhausting to the average voter. What do you feel is the significance of having an RRD next to your name?
I grew up in the Republican Party and have as a mentor Nancy Kassebaum. That is the ideology, if you would call it that, that I aspire to as a Republican. Are there people in my party that have disappointed me? Yes. Are there people in the Democratic Party lately that have disappointed me? Yes. I don't like partisan politics. I think there is no place once you get into the legislature. It's time to move on and do what's best for the people. I have lived that for the last 7 years. My first year in the House, we had the ability to have a bipartisan coalition. We had to have a 1 cent sales tax. This was during the Great Recession, and we passed the budget, and I was a very proud supporter of that, and the people were happy with that. We have not had those numbers. Unfortunately, for the Democrats, their numbers went so far down, as did moderate Republicans, and so we didn't have enough numbers to have any kind of a coalition. Mm-hmm. I will not be surprised at all if we have that opportunity in the future. But for me, I stay a member of the Republican Party because I'm trying to bring it back to a place that we all can say Democrat, Republican, there are little differences, but the main thing is we're all out there working the best we know for the people, maybe in different ways, but certainly not trying to stymie one another, but instead work together for this great country and our great community in Johnson County.
Okay, and then if you could each give a brief statement just about your run for your position to share with and leave with our viewers. Megan, you can...
Sure, and I just wanted to follow up, too, about partisanship briefly. We do have 2 more years of Brownback, and as a Democrat, I would be on committees that the number of Republicans that are overall elected and the number of Democrats are the proportionally the amount of people that sit on the committees. So it doesn't mean that necessarily if Ms. Beaulieu is elected that she'll be on a committee if we have Governor Brownback leading the way. But as a Democrat, I will be on committees. Mm-hmm. I have 8 years of experience, of positive experience, making positive changes through the recession, equality, long-term financing, public parks, art, and those are the types of changes I would like to make in the legislature. And I feel that my opponent just has 8 years, but doesn't really have anything to show for those 8 years. It's not been a positive experience.
Thank you so much, Megan. Mm-hmm. And Barbara, if you could share, just leave the viewers with a brief statement about your run and what you stand for.
Well, I'm excited to continue with the positive impact that I have had on this state and my community, representing the people well, being available, and seeing that as much good public policy comes forward as is possible, and that certain public policy that may not be in our best interest is stopped. Both of those are important parts of the legislature. I would say it's important for people to know that a person like me cares deeply about the community and has been able to validate that statement by my votes that I've had for the last 7 years, and to know that the experience that I bring will be invaluable as we set forth on two of the biggest issues that we've had in years, if not ever, which is to put both a failing budgetary situation that needs to be resolved combined with writing a new school funding formula. Those are going to take intense, extreme knowledge to be able to help move those things forward. I have those, and I'm excited to put them to use. So thank you for having me today.
Thank you both for being on. Any final comment, Sharon, before we transition to the break and our next guest?
I just was sitting here listening and thinking, I don't hear very much difference between the two of these people, actually. And I don't know, unless I'm missing something. But good luck to both of you.
Thank you.
And thank you for being on the Every Woman Show. And we will take a station break and be back with Z Hall.
KKFI would like to take a moment to thank Californos for providing food for our volunteers during our 2016 Fall Pledge Drive and for their continued support over the years in keeping community radio on the air. Thank you, Californos. We couldn't do it without you.
Johnson County Community College and Park University are sponsoring a peace-building conference November 4th and 5th. Registration is free and open to the public. This year's theme is Redefining Us Versus Them. For more information, search the web for 2016 Peacebuilding Conference at Park University. This message is a public service of 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
And Dr. Z Hall is joining us, and we are going to make a decidedly different transition in conversation and just kind of follow up on just a personal issue that that I've dealt with, that my family members, some females in my family members have spoken about, and I called Dr. Z Hall to just talk about this issue of black women and black men and us standing in the gap maybe too much sometimes, and not taking care of ourselves. And Dr. Z, help us out here. Can you just tell us what information you have to share on this subject? And I know you said you've been having this conversation with some people as well online and in different forums.
Yes, and it's taken many, many different directions. And I'm not sure exactly how the conversation went on air on Every Woman last week. So I don't know exactly which direction things went there. But some of the conversations that I've had with people have varied so much. In favor of feminism, men and women, and then others who don't think feminism is a good thing for society. So, and it can be, it has been approached from many, many directions, from a religious perspective, from an education perspective, from family and what have you. And so what I wanted to do today, not having any insight in what the conversation was last week, was to approach it from, or is to approach it from, a criminal justice perspective.
And I just want to make a comment to our listeners. Amy Bell is feeling a little bit better, perhaps. Amy, she's called in to join us.
Oh, good.
Amy, are you there?
I am there. Still not really sounding great for radio, but following up from last week, I just thought it was very important, especially when you have white feminists who don't experience this, and how, you know, I feel like I didn't react well. And I wanted to, like, throw that in there, that it was a confusing experience for me.
Yeah, me too. Me too, Z. So, yeah. So Amy will be on to chime in with us.
Hi, Amy. I hope you feel better soon.
Oh, thank you.
So from a criminal justice perspective, I just wanted to point out that what the situation is, and what might we can think about this as one example of some of the reasons why women can be very protective of men. In the United States, 2.3 million people are in our jails or prisons around the country, and another 4.5 million people are on probation or parole in the U.S. And so that's a total of like 6.8 million people that are under criminal justice supervision of some sort. That's one in every 35 adults. That's a really high number. It's the highest number of any nation in the world. And among those incarcerated, nearly 1 million of those people are black persons. Mm-hmm. And this is significant because, according to the U.S. Census of 2015, black people make up only 13.3% of the U.S. population. So this is an incredibly high incarceration rate for black people. So the threat to black people, men and women, is really, really high. One in every 100 black women she's incarcerated, and one in every six black men are incarcerated. So, and if this trend continues, one in three black men will be incarcerated at some point in their lifetime. Mm-hmm. That's an incredibly high incarceration rate and criminal justice rate. Now, when I was just a student in law school, our dean, Dean Hoflick at the time, he played the film Driving While Black. A lot of people have heard of this film and watched it. And it was amazing to me at that time that a number of the white students felt like, well, yes, black people experience more incarceration because they're criminals. Mm-hmm. And so we won't be able to go into all of that today, but I would like to point listeners to June 2nd, 2015 Huffington Post article that's available online, and it's 40 Reasons Why Our Jails Are Full of Black and Poor Persons. And in that, among those 40 reasons, none of them are because black people are more criminal. But it's a very interesting read, so I highly recommend that our listeners, you know, check that out. So the incarceration rate and the threat of incarceration is very real. Now, what that means is a breakup of the black family, right? Mm-hmm. And this is a historic thing, the breakup of the black family in the United States. It's the same thing that happened during slavery. People were sold off, and the family unit was broken up. Mm-hmm. It's the same thing that happened during Jim Crow. Black persons were hung, mainly men, and breaking up the black family once again. So the threat to the black family and to the black man, it's real. Mm-hmm. And so I just wanted to make sure that that's clear, because it's important not to know that, you know, this is not an strange thinking on the part of black women.
I want to say, Z, to your, you know, some of the statements that you made. So last week, even I spoke to my sister about it, just kind of after the show,
And Amy and Sharon were telling me I was just being very protective, you know, of our guests. And I thought, really? You know, and then I told, and so, you know, I just took it in and wanted to sit with it and say, okay, you know, was I? And then I told my sister, I said, you know, subconsciously, because for our listeners, I'm sitting here visually, mm-hmm. and there, I'm a black woman. Our guest was a black man.
Okay.
And Amy and Sharon are two white females.
Okay.
And I think, unconsciously, I was thinking to myself, I can't let these two white females jump on this black man,
oh,
you know, like
okay.
attack this black man. And I didn't think about it during the interview, mm-hmm. but afterwards I thought to myself, you know, visually, maybe that's what I'm thinking, like, don't jump on him, you know, like, don't like go after him. And, you know, in that visual scene, I felt like this instinctive, like, this, don't do this. You may disagree, but let's not, like, you know, go to this level. So it's like, and he didn't even, I mean, I was saying more of it. So it was, after I kind of sat with it, it was interesting to me, my own
reaction,
you know, feelings. Yeah, mm-hmm. feelings that just kind of came to the surface. And Amy's like, well, you don't do this other times. And I was like, well, what? And then I just kind of thought about it, like, gosh, you know, it just,
yeah.
you know, it brought some things up in me. And even with how my sisters and I will say in our family, and we have my mom, my father passed when I was very young, and my siblings and I, but we have one brother. And so there are three girls, there's three of us that are girls, and then there's my brother. And we felt like my mom was very protective of my brother, like to the point where I think she wanted us to be so strong, and she gave him a little bit more tender love and care than us. And so, you know, I think we kind of took that on, you know, when we grew up. And then at some point, there's a show that I like. They said, well, who's going to love the black woman? You know, like, mm-hmm. she's out there doing all of these things, but what's going on with her protection and her kind of self-care, and right. not feeling always having to be like this strong image per se?
Well, there's this Amy, whole nation.
Amy, you have a question, comment?
Well, I just wanted to ask, would this be a good time? Because I also spent the week kind of reflecting on what happened last week and where I stood in that. And I don't know if our guests would like to speak to what you just said, or if it's a good time for me to share my reflections as well now.
Well, the connection I wanted to make with the historic breaking up of the black family and the man being the head of the family, which is not a cultural thing that is specific to black people. We live in a Christian nation, and Abrahamic religious traditions teach that the man is the head of the household. This is the Torah, the Greek scriptures, and also the Quran all teach that the man is the head of the household and head of the woman. These are traditions, religious traditions that many of us live with and have been taught when we were young. I was taught the same thing. And so according to these traditions, Adam was created first. He had a personal relationship with God, and woman was created from Adam's rib.
Mm-hmm.
This genealogically creates a hierarchy. God, man, woman. And so
that's exactly what he said last week. Did he? Yeah, that's exactly what
I'm
saying.
I'm going to have to intercede here. Okay. That is providing you believe some, to me, it's a mythical thing that was handed down. And as it did come out last week, 40 men wrote this book. And I said it would be a different book if 40 women had written it.
Yeah.
So I can't absorb that, nor can I accept that just simply because it's been taught to us. We've been taught a lot of things that aren't correct.
Yeah, and I'm not suggesting we should accept it because we've been taught. I'm just simply laying, responding mm-hmm. to the question, why do women respond this way? Not necessarily, you didn't hear me say that I actually believe it. I said, this
okay,
is what's
good,
taught.
Good.
So, because I was taught that. And mm-hmm. most people, we live in a Christian nation, and that's what a lot of people live by. In other words, what I wanted to make real clear is that the overprotecting of the male mm-hmm. is not a racial thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's a mostly a religious teaching kind of thing. And so I've seen this in white women as well. Mm-hmm. I remember when I was a really young woman, I approached one of my bosses, and she was a white woman, and I asked her, well, how should I handle this situation? It was an employer, somebody working in our office, that had made some sexual overtures. And her response was, well, just don't embarrass him. Mm-hmm. Well, initially I thought, well, wow, is that because I'm a black woman? I'm not supposed to tell this white man he can't put his hands on me? It wasn't that. I learned later. It was that she had been taught that as well, that you don't do these things. You make things, the world, a safe place for men. Mm-hmm. And so I recognized early on that this wasn't a thing that was peculiar to black women. So now, coming back to this creation story, I've always had a problem with the story of creation. Mm-hmm. And that is this. It relates to this. The universe is efficient in everything that happens. And one good example of that, I'm a grower. I've been growing food for 8 years. One good example of that is the fact that a plant creates its own seeds. It makes sure that its reproduction happens. If you look at anything in the universe, it is highly efficient. Now, according to Abrahamic religious traditions, God created Eve by performing surgery on Adam, taking a rib and creating her from his rib. That would be highly inefficient, highly inefficient. And so it's always made sense to me that the woman was created first. Now, let me, and I want to make this really clear. Now, if we can believe that Jesus was the product of a miraculous birth, I don't see a real jump in Adam having been the product of a miraculous birth, that Eve gave birth to Adam. That's efficient. That means that there was no surgery. That means Adam would not need anesthesia. It means that he would not have a post-surgery abnormality and all of these other things that would come from having your rib removed. The story just never made sense to me. And the thing that seals the story for me is that there is no other instance in Abrahamic tradition of a miraculous surgery, not a single one. But the miraculous birth of Christ, with Mary giving birth to a son, it says at Matthew 1:21, she will bring forth a son. It says the same thing in Luke 1:31, that she would bring forth a son without the help of a male. If Eve gave birth to Adam, that would be set the precedent for the birth of Christ, because that would be the same process. That story makes sense to me because it's efficient. And so this whole thing that which would disrupt the hierarchy that was created with the male creation story, mm-hmm. where there's God, Adam, and Eve. But if there was God, Eve, and Adam, we have a different paradigm. And that's what people are afraid of with feminism. And the fear is related to how men have abused that sort of privileged position that they've had based on that story. And the fear is that, well, if women take that place, how would they treat us if that hierarky changed? So that's, yeah.
Now, Amy, are you there? Are you still?
Yes, I am.
Okay. So you want to share some of your reflections on last week?
Well, I like everything that our guests have been talking about here, but I wanted to add that I was sitting there thinking, you know, is it, though, a different scenario when you do have what we were talking about earlier with this increased danger of living as a black man in society, and if, you know, that protection of a black man is completely justified, even if I can't really myself participate in the framework that the conversation was based around?
I don't have the benefit of having knowing what that conversation was, so I'm kind of in the dark there. So I'm kind of, you know, responding to just what Ebony and I had talked about, and the and sharing some of the conversations I've been having over the last 2 weeks, and actually posted this whole thing on my blog as well, and people can go there and read that as well if they'd like to. It's at 360degresz.blogspot.com. So I don't have that perspective, Amy, but if you want to give a little bit of, you know, kind of what triggered that for you, maybe, you know, I could share.
Well, I think a lot of the conversation, it was kind of coming around this, like you said, the socialization that we all have, where there's this hierarchy where women just are at the bottom of it. Mm-hmm. And it kind of has a bit of a visceral response where it's just like, no, I won't be subjugated like that anymore, you know?
Yeah.
And so I wasn't really comfortable giving credence to somebody saying that. But at the same time, like I said, I don't want to silence a prevalent voice. And especially didn't want to disproportionately silence the voice of our Black communities. And kind of that was my struggle this week.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. My feeling is that what's happened is, according to the Abrahamic tradition, men are supposed to be knowledgeable of, you know, women, and particularly their wives, and lead with love and grace. And I think much of the fear that those who are against feminism, and those are not just men, but I think the big fear is that if there was a change in seating, if you will, that the abuse would come the other way. And that happens a lot when people are in situations where they've oppressed others, whether it's a racial oppression or gendered oppression or sexual oppression, it tends to happen. But the thing is that women have, you know, equal rights in terms of their humanity, and their humanity should be respected. Our humanity should be respected and honored just as the man's is. And of the men that I've heard speak out against feminism, what they feel is not proper is that women should even have a humanistic role to play in society. And I think that's a really sad thing.
Yeah, it kind of, even like to Amy's point, for me, Amy talks about a little bit of last week about cross-functional feminism, and I feel like I was at that crossroads last week where, you know, here I am in agreement with these two feminists, but then at the same time I'm also was considered a Black American, and so I'm looking at myself as this is me on both sides of the table, and I don't want one side to attack the other, nor do I want the other to attack the other. So it's like, at both points, you know, I kind of feel like, gosh, like I'm each person here.
Well, I might have contributed to that a wee bit. Amy was not in the room prior to the show starting, and Melvin and I were going back and forth, back and forth, and I was giving him a heck of a hard time. And so I explained to Amy that I thought I might have, you might have been fearful. I don't think I was rude to him, but I certainly wasn't standing down to him. I'm not accustomed to standing down to anybody any longer.
And that's the point. Like, it's like I don't want anyone to not speak their voice, but it was just kind of like we talked about a little bit earlier, Z, in the week, just this, I don't know, this unconscious feeling of, oh my God, you know, like, I don't want this to get into a war where you just, like, rip into this guy, like, I, you know, disagree with him, but I think maybe pre-show you made a comment about, I could just rip right into him, because, or people like him, or something, and so.
Prior to him coming in the room, you know, I was just foaming at the mouth to get ready for him.
But with that, where Donna's going to get us, Donna's in for the next show, so.
Are we over?
Oh my gosh, we are done. Z has, you have a
final announcement,
and then we're gonna.
I am the executive producer of Salon 360, and next month we will be having a program event centered on the theme female sexuality. It will be Thursday, November 10th from 6:30 to 8:30 at Andre's, 5018 Main Street, Kansas City, Missouri. And you can check out our and follow us on Facebook.com/groups/salon360 to keep up with information. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Dr. Hall, and thank you everyone for tuning in to KKFI and listening to the Every Woman Show. Coming up is Urban Connections with Donna Wolf, and then later, guess who's coming to Canada?